It's about value. It's about what are you getting for that fee?
Tom Morgan has worked in the financial advice industry for 12 years, and recently he's decided to go it alone, leaving the firm he'd been working with because he has big concerns about how the industry works.
Active management doesn't add any consistent value, only costs.
If you could advise everyone, what would you be saying?
This is the biggest problem people have.
I have always had a pretty dim view of financial advisors because of my own personal life, personal experiences with them, and then relatives and stuff. And you're probably one of the three people that, or three advisors that I've encountered since doing YouTube that kind of changed my mind on the industry. As in, I see that there's good people working in it, and I see that it has a very valuable need, that it serves a purpose, if that makes sense.
But
I also know that you've been on your own journey with financial advice that we want to get into today. And I think you've got some refreshing takes on the industry, leaving the industry, because we spoke about that decision. And we had chats offline where you were like, I'm thinking of leaving. I'm thinking of setting up by myself. Big risk.
Counsel me, Damo.
Yeah. Help me jump. I mean, scary, right? Like scary thing, but I don't know how much you want to share, but you told me a story that you had at your old place that kind of was like the moment where you were like, I'm gone.
Yeah, so the pitch always was, come and see me as an advisor. I've got all these fantastic reach. Come and look at the investment team, right? We've got 16 guys here with more screens than you've ever seen. Graphs on every, it looked bonkers, right? I had no idea what half those graphs was, you know, on those screens, but it looked seriously impressive. And the idea was you'd be saying to the clients, so look at all that research. You come with us, you give us your lump sum, we'll invest it. These guys are going to research, look at it, chop change. If one investment isn't doing what it should do, we'll swap it. You know, active management in its essence. That was the world I started in. And I've sort of been in that world for a long time and noticed the shift, of course, with the whole passive story. And that's not a new story, but it's one that's definitely gathered more and more noise. And you get to a point in your career, really, where I could no longer ignore the sheer facts of the matter, which are that, as we've discussed, active management doesn't add any consistent value, only costs. You know, that is the truth of the matter. When you look at long-term data and actually look at the evidence, there is no compelling story. And this is me as a financial planner saying, and this is what I would say to clients now, is there is no compelling story that active management adds any value over passive management. And especially because it adds a layer of cost as well. I think this idea now of, you know, I mean, we've spoken about it before. I go and see a financial advisor. He charges me X to go and put together a portfolio of, let's say, index funds. I could go and do that myself. Why would I pay a financial advisor 3,000 quid to go and build something that now, with the way that the world is and the internet and all the developments with platforms, you know, that's quite straightforward to do with perhaps a little bit of research, you know, on the outset. There's plenty out there that do that kind of thing, you know, and it's all about the products. And so I was having this conversation with, you know, the sort of larger firm that I was with. And it sort of came back to me that, yes, Tom, but that's not what keeps the lights on. That's what the phrase that came to me was over the phone. And I remember sitting there and in the deathly silence of not knowing how to respond to that. What they were basically saying is, we know what you're saying, Tom, and, you know, not disagreeing or agreeing. I'm not going to get into the weeds of that discussion. But if everybody did what you're proposing to do of just using low-cost solutions and bolting clients into those and just concentrate on the planning, then there would be none of this, you know, this great machine, these fantastic offices, you know, and also roots in for the industry. It's what pays for the training for the next generation. You know, it's what drives profit in an industry to have an industry. Without that, the industry would almost, if everybody did that, would the industry fall over? But that was the moment that I really realized, that stared me in the face, that said, your beliefs, Tom, are different to what your current setup is. And you have a decision to make on how you go forward. And I want to build something that I'm dead proud of. And that was directly in conflict with that. That was the final thing that pushed me over the edge, I think.
Do you feel scared about criticizing the industry at all?
It crossed my mind, I must say. It did cross my mind. But then I was sat thinking about it and I thought, it's coming from a place of intent of, you know, I love this industry. I think there's a massive place for it. I believe it delivers great value when it's done properly. I think there's two main problems at the moment, based on my experience, which is one, a total misconception of what good advice looks like and what the role of a financial advisor is. I mean, I call myself a financial planner to differentiate really, because I feel they are two different things. Everyone has the same worries. Let's say you look at someone going to retirement. It doesn't matter whether they've got a massive pot or a relatively modest pot, whatever the story is. They're all worried about the same thing, which is, will we be okay? Have we got enough? Can we actually do this? You know, we've reached the top of the mountain. We've built the pots. They're as big as they're ever going to be. We're now going to start spending them and retire. You know, are we going to be okay? And that's nothing about the products. That's about looking at the story, you know, and using some clever software that we have available now to model the story and look at, well, let's stress test it. Let's see if you do have enough.
I think this distinction between advice and planning is really interesting. Mm. I want to get into that because I think it will help people when they go to a financial advisor or planner go, I want this kind of service.
Yeah.
You've been in the space 12 years. You say that it's had massive changes over that time. Like, when, how is it different to when you first went in? Like, the incentives and how you went about it and how has it changed in that time?
Yeah. Well, interestingly, the reason I got involved in the industry is it was right around the time that the thing at the time was called RDR, the Retail Distribution Reviews, this bit of legislation that was all, you know, regulator driven. And it was the first big stride on sorting out financial advice. You know, we want to be seen as a profession alongside solicitors, accountants, and be seen as that professional service. But it was miles away really from that for various reasons. What RDR was about, amongst a couple of the main things that it did, was one, ban commission. So you no longer had this environment where you'd go see an advisor. It'd be really hard to understand how are they getting paid? It'd be some kind of commission-based arrangement with the investments.
Kickbacks.
So that was all stopped, along with raising the bar on the qualification level. To call yourself a financial advisor, you no longer need this qualification. You now need this qualification. And it was a massive step up. That's when I entered the industry, because I was looking from the outside, looking in, thinking loads of advisors are going to leave now. The whole thing is changing, which is a massive opportunity. And that's where I came in. So that was a big change then. What I've seen in the time going back there 12 years ago to now, the industry has been consolidating massively. So less and less firms, more and more bigger firms. You know, smaller, back in the day, financial advisors used to be a one and two man operation on the high street. There are still some, but it's few and far between. They've been gobbled up by bigger consolidator firms, which end up in these situations where you've got one company that's now the amalgamation of what was 26 different businesses that all did things in a slightly different way, all bolted together, and they sort of become a bit of a Frankenstein, really. That's been happening a lot.
So, like, a reflection that I see of that is where I live. There's financial advisors in every... It's a relatively affluent area, and each town in the borough almost has... It's like high street.
Yep.
And the biggest building on every high street is a wealth manager. But you look behind the curtain and it's at SJP.
Yeah.
It's St. James's Place. Mm. So it's like brothers and sons.
Yeah.
But brothers and sons, it's almost like a franchise model, isn't
yeah.
it? Can
yeah.
you explain how that big conglomerate works in these... little towns.
Yeah, so, you know, SJP, they're always the example.
St. James's Place.
St. James's Place, this is. They're always the example. And I think St. James's Place have long been the biggest, and therefore they've always got the biggest target on their back. So it's kind of, I always try and steer away a little bit from the criticism. SJP get plenty of stick in the press and does that job for it. A lot of it is justified. But I have also met some really great people that work mm-hmm. under SJP. There are some great advisors there. I've met them that do care, trying to do a great job. You know, so it's not fair to say all SJP advisors are bad. I don't agree with that statement. However,
we're going to clip that.
Okay.
All SJP advisors yeah. are bad.
Put it on the thumbnail.
Clip it, re-edit.
Put it on the thumbnail. Yeah. We're good.
Looking forward to that. Where's that waiver I saw?
There are
some really great people there, genuinely. But what happens is, so they're running, they call them partner practices, I think. I'm not the expert on the SJP model, but they've spoken to me many times over the years, trying to entice you in. They're running small businesses within the wider framework, which is actually where my story began, not with SJP, but that's the kind of model that until recently I've been involved in. So you're a self-employed advisor running your own business, looking after your own clients, but under the framework of a larger organization.
It's a franchise, like it's, that. It's like Subway or McDonald's,
yeah,
right?
Very similar, yeah.
They're providing you with the big ingredients, the funds, or?
So you get the tools, the research, you know, the marketing, the brochures, a big building to put on your website, you know, to scale it up. Essentially, the idea being, you just need to go and find the clients. We've got everything, all the processes, all built. So you go find the clients and you take them through that journey.
But they have, do they also offer like, their own funds, like their own SJP funds.
Yeah.
So compared to how you said it was when you joined the industry 12 years ago, isn't that kind of the same thing? Because they're not backhanders.
They're still incentivized.
They're still incentivizing to push you into one investment channel.
Yeah, so again, this is where it gets a bit complicated, but this is what they call vertical integration, right? Which is sort of one of my criticisms really in the direction of travel. This is the idea where you go and see an advice firm, you know, Brothers and Sons on that high street. They're actually a partner practice of SJP. The advice you're going to get from that advisor, whatever is arranged, the investments, will be SJP products, SJP funds. That's the model. They're a restricted advice proposition. So actually, it's quite honest and badged up as that. You would be told that at the outset, and your agreement would say that, to say, we will advise you on SJP products and funds. And of course, they're designed to be, you know, suitable for a wide range of people, and it will still be regulated and good advice. But to be independent, which is what the world that I am now, I've been both. I've been independent and I've been restricted. So I've seen both sides of the model. I always use the toolkit analogy. These advisors and me, when I was in that restricted model, I had a smaller toolkit and I want a bigger toolkit. And I believe that will enable better outcomes, at least the same outcomes, if not better.
Do you think the traditional space has a systemic issue that they're offering the wrong sort of service or value proposition to people?
Yeah, interesting. I don't know whether it's systemic issue. I can only talk about my own experience. I don't know the whole industry, but I definitely feel that this focus on with the bigger firms of the vertical integration model, where they own, you know, they've got the advice part of the business, then they've got their own platform. It might be a white labeled version of another platform, or it's actually their own that they've built. And then, you know, sometimes their own funds as well. I think when you focus on that part of the chain, you naturally detract from potentially the advice bit. All I'm interested in personally is the advice bit. I have no interest in designing my own platform. There's great platforms out there I'm quite happy to use. And with an independent hat on, I can research and choose the best one. So I think the further we go down this road of consolidating into bigger firms and looking for value at that other end of the chain, they're trying to find value and, you know, ways of making profit out of the results, the tools, if you like, as well as the advice, then that detracts from the advice.
It's the same with, I think people can probably relate with mortgages, right? Mm. Like a tied mortgage advisor, or your bank will only advise on their products, whereas someone who's got the whole market might be able to find you a better deal. Or
exactly. So, you know, I've got a panel of these five I'll choose from, but if you saw an independent mortgage broker that had the whole of the market, the likelihood is you might still end up with a great deal with that person with the panel, because there might be a great panel with great products and services. But I'm a big believer in, surely, more choice is always better, right? Because if I'm independent, I've also got that panel.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So I can't think of many examples. You can still get a good outcome from the restricted model, but I still think if you've got a great advisor, they would be better being pulled out of that model and put in an independent place. I believe that.
Okay. I think one thing that I've learned is SJP provide like free training, or they get you to qualification. And another thing that's attractive to advisors is they provide a marketplace to sell your business. I also think that they pick up people that they're a big brand, right? When I first started investing, I invested with HL, Hargreaves Lansdown, because they were the big brand. And then after a few years, I was like, actually, these guys are pretty expensive. I can get it cheaper elsewhere. And it feels like SJP are a bit like that, like this massive shiny beacon of a financial advice brand that people just go to because they're the guys. And then you're kind of locked in.
Yeah.
And you've mentioned the fees, and we had a chat about how certain fees within the industry are more set up for, they're harvesting fees more than they are providing good outcomes. Do you want to have a chat about that?
Sorry, what are harvesting fees?
Yeah, so you're talking about, it's the business is designed to just create fees and make fit more so than the outcome isn't the important bit. It's about what products can I get you to take to generate the fees to pay for my living, if you like. Whereas, you know, from a planning point of view, I mean, the job that I do, you know, the first 80% of a client journey with me, there's nothing to do with product. I haven't even got to that bit yet. That's the bit I bring in at the end that I say, these are the tools that are going to deliver on the plan that we set up, but I want to spend four meetings with you and all of my time really getting that bit built and designed. So then I can bring in the tools. It's almost like the little bit at the end to complement it, not the other way around.
Some of the fees that I've seen that exist in your industry are things like exit fees, penalties for leaving and moving. And these to me seem really pervasive and just very negatively set up, so that once people realize, oh, I could do this myself, it's like, you're tied in. Like, how can you just give us a rundown of some of these kinds of things that people
use? I'm totally with you on that. I hate any, I've never recommended products that have tie-in. I've always been of the view of, if it's a great product, a great service, and it was the right thing for you because you've gone through a proper piece of regulated advice, why should it need to have a vehicle at which to stop you getting out if it turns, you know, that tells me that there's probably something that is a square peg in a round hole there in order to bring that in. You know, SJP, and really that's one of the big criticisms they've always had without, you know, and I know they're in a process actually of completely rethinking their charging structure through lots of this sort of story. But I, you know, there probably are many clients that are in SJP products that if the exit fee situation wasn't there, would they still be in them? I don't know. Yeah, that's the thing that's holding them back potentially.
Yeah, the retention's quite high though, isn't it, across them? 93%. Is that the exit fees or is it because they offer a good service?
The cynic would say it's the exit fees, wouldn't they? I don't think that would be fair. It can't be 93% of people. It's not accurate, is it? If you surveyed, I'm sure, you know, a good selection of clients that are with SJP, you are going to find plenty that actually say, no, you know, Joe Smith's been great. He's looked after my family for 15 years. He did my mum, my dad, you know, and all of that. So some of it will be good retention, but some of it will just be not knowing what's the other side of the fence. You know, what have they ever really explored? What might be other options on the side of the fence? We operate, we have to be aware that the job that I do is based so much on trust. So I've looked after clients, some of my clients been with me 12 years. I've seen them, you know, twice a year for 12 years. I know their kids, you know, you end up with quite a close relationship. And so that is, are they ever going to look the other side of the fence? Because actually they end up buying into that person, you know, and that's a great place to be from, you know, building a great trusted relationship, but it has its problems as well. Are they ever going to look at, you know, another solution?
Yeah, you often get this like thing of, he's a family friend, the advisor. Yeah. That's very hard to kind of like walk away from, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, like to play the other side of this, my mom is with SJP and, you know, she's been with them a long time and she was able to retire early because of the advice that she received from SJP, and she might have been able to retire even earlier. Yeah. But my mom would have said before I started my YouTube channel, I will never invest because I don't get it. She might not have even understood that she was investing through SJP. Yeah. They got her there. They held her hand and they got her there. And if you say to my mom, was it worth it? She'd be like, damn right, it was worth it.
Yeah.
Because now I'm sat here retired early and so is my husband.
It's the perfect example.
And they got her there.
Yeah.
And like, you know, whatever, like it might not have been the quickest car. It might have been a bit more expensive, but they got to where she needed to be.
Exactly. If the other version was she'd never have invested.
She would
have.
Without that
chap going to see her and saying, have you thought about, can you spare another 100 quid for the pension? Mm. You know, and just keep nudging, keep pushing, keep encouraging. She may well have never got there. Could she have got there quicker? Yeah, probably. Yeah. But it was still a good outcome.
Yeah. So as a passive index investor, I am like, oh, but you could have done, but then actually no, like they got what they wanted in the end.
Yeah.
Who would you say the biggest competitor for St. James's Place is?
Yeah, now that's a really good question.
You, now. Watch out.
After this episode, it's going to be you.
Little old man, I'll leave some cards on the table. Yeah, it's a good question. So this consolidation, you know, means that there are some big players in on the sort of league tables. So in terms of competitors, people competing with SJP, you've got Rathbones, Evelyn Partners, Quilters are a pretty big outfit. I know they've got a training academy. They're trying to solve the riddle of bringing in new advisors. So yeah, there's you know, certainly 10 big outfits out there.
And what do you think a person should be looking for from a financial advisor so that they get a good one?
Ask them about the planning. Do you do financial planning? You know, is that what you do, or are you just here to advise me on my investments? That's the first question that I would ask and get to the nub of that issue. Investment philosophy, I think, is a big thing. You know, ask them, what is your investment philosophy? Do you believe in active management? You know, what kind of thing do you believe in? What do the investments that you've set up look like? And make sure that matches your view. Now, that can be a challenge because some clients have no idea, right? They come to me and go, whatever you say is what I'll sort of end up doing, right? Active men, some, you know, some aren't interested in that side of it at all. They just come to you for the planning and then say, whatever you tell me the tools are, Tom, that's the tools. I've come to you as the expert. I don't take my car to the garage and lean over the mechanic and say, I would have done that slightly different. Yeah? So, but I think it's important to question that investment philosophy. You know, my view is the passive world, as we've discussed. I know there are still lots on the active side. And if that's what you want as a client and you believe in that world and you want that story, then, you know, make sure it matches one way or another. And make sure the fee structure is really transparent and you understand it. If that comes with a really long-winded, weird answer, then that always fills me full of dread.
And so you should be looking, if you look at exit fees as well?
You'll find most, I would say, SJP advisors perhaps different because of the products, but again, I think this is part of the overhaul they're making, I think, is to rid this exit fee story. Okay. As I understand it, question marks over whether they've been driven to do that by consumer duty and the regulator's latest thing, or is it, have they realized the error of their ways, or have they been shown the error of their ways? I mean, I don't know. But yeah, you don't want to be tied into things. Yeah.
What does a fee model look like that you think is acceptable then, in terms of like what would your fees be per se? You don't need to share that exactly, but
yeah, I'm very happy to. I mean, I believe in being as transparent as possible. Mm-hmm. So there's three main bits to my fee structure, okay? So for the financial planning bit, the building of that roadmap, I charge a fixed fee, and that's £1,500. Mm-hmm. And that's for that bit of the story. So all the information gathering, you know, it's quite a lot to get on terms of what have you got in what pots, what are you investing, what do they look like, and what do you want, and all of those conversations. So that comes with that cost. Then I charge based on how much is invested for the tools that then come into that plan. So a one-off fee of 2% of the first 200,000 that gets invested, and then 1% on anything thereafter, which is well below the industry average, because I did a huge amount of research to make sure I was competitively charged, but it's still a sum of money. You know, just people are investing big sums. That's a one-off cost. And then the ongoing cost is the final piece of the puzzle. There's two different levels to it. Most of my clients pay 0.85% a year to have me as their financial planner on their assets. Mm-hmm. There is, you know, a conversation on, you know, fixed fees, because some of my fees there, one is fixed, two are based on a percentage level. I believe it's fair as the industry sits at the moment on how, what happens is the more money you manage, the more risk you take on as an advisor. My fees are based on that in terms of what I pay to the regulator and all the rest of it. So it's all balanced in that way. So that's the fee structure. So it's dead transparent, and that's what it is. And, you know, we don't waver from it. And I believe that you should be able to, whoever the advisor is that you're looking to work with, should be able to articulate it short and succinctly.
So what amount of capital, like what sort of region of capital do people need to invest with you or with other financial advisors? What's the minimum?
So for me, in my current setup, again, you're looking at, you know, a small outfit, if you like, a bit of a boutique-y setup, and I've only got so many seats spare. 200,000 plus really is my sweet spot. So that's not to say I have a real, you know, sort of firm line on that, but the most of the value I find and getting a bum on one of those seats is there and north. Lots of bigger firms, because they're bigger and they therefore have more cogs to the wheel, you'll find that barrier of entry lower. Typically 50,000 is probably a figure you'll find a lot with some of the bigger ones. I think that's SJP's minimum. I'm not entirely sure. But of course, then you've got everyone below that. The question then is, well, what's the solution for all the people, of which there are loads, starting out up to that value? Because could they benefit from financial advice? Yes, of course they could. Somebody to sit and show them and talk to them about, you know, what kind of tax efficient wrappers there are and how to buy a fund and what a fund is and why perhaps, you know, buying individual stocks is not the way to go, and all of that side. Of course they benefit from that. But this is the challenge, is where are they getting that information from if they can't get to see an advisor? Because probably at very least, you need 50,000 before you're going to sit across a table. And this is where more education is needed, you know, from the start. There needs to be a better way of knowing that there's some great information out there that you can sort of rely on, and yeah, it's come from a good source and not, you know, some TikToker with their, you know, pants off or whatever. That's not a great example. But
what are you watching?
Yeah. Mainly you.
Yeah.
Yeah, so there's definitely a place. So imagine a world where you got people that were, you know, credible sources to come together and build some kind of almost academy, you know, course for beginners, etc. It's always fraught with challenges, especially for somebody like me that's regulated in a space. It's really hard because that line is a challenge, advice and guidance. And at what point do you stray out of, I'm just giving you information to, well, I acted on that. That's a challenging place to be. And I guess that you have to take some responsibility as an individual consumer to say, how do I make sure that this source is decent? You know, there's loads of work to be done on this area for sure.
Can you guess what the biggest learning has been from doing this podcast or even my YouTube channel? It's that the most important investment you can make is in you. So for me, my path to real wealth isn't through investing, it's by building this business. And that's why I'm happy that we're working with Hostinger. Hostinger help entrepreneurs, freelancers and side hustlers with their websites. My favourite thing is their AI website builder, which helps anyone create a professional website with zero coding experience. You just describe your goal in a couple of sentences and the AI creates a beautiful looking website just like magic. You can then customize it, use the AI assistant to generate SEO-friendly text, and even use their AI logo maker. It's fast, user-friendly, and of course, what I like the best is it's great value for money. You can get website hosting and a free domain from £2.99 a month. So if you want a website, then check out Hostinger. And if you use the code MAKINGMONEY, that's making money all one word, you'll get 10% off. And I've left a link in the description for you. Before I became a creator, I was a sales guy. I mean, I love selling. It's how I rebuilt my life after some wrong turns in my 20s. I also delivered Chinese takeaways on the side, but that was more fun money so I could go out on a night without feeling guilty. Sales was where the real money was at. And one tool that I found really useful was LinkedIn Sales Navigator. It's a sales intelligence platform that helps you identify and then get into conversations with high-value customers so you can drive more revenue. You can use it to look for key signals like recent job changes, so you can find buyers who are most likely to convert. And because they've got a billion people on the platform, I mean, the chances are your targets are going to be on LinkedIn. Sales Navigator gives you the most up-to-date, first-party data, so you can get into conversations with the people that matter. So if you want to give Sales Navigator a try, you can get a 60-day free trial at linkedin.com/upsell. That's linkedin.com/UPSELL for a 60-day free trial.
So do you think there's been a regulatory shift then in terms, you said that there was a big change when you first got in. Has there been changes recently?
Yeah, so there has. And, you know, ongoing, this will just keep happening. We had, you know, this big initiative, treating customers fairly, which seems like the most obvious thing. Yeah. You know,
you've got to be nice to them.
You've got to treat them fairly. It seems mad, doesn't it? The latest one is consumer duty, this huge, which is basically the treating customers fairly piece, but on steroids. They've taken that piece that they did a little while back and bolted on a load more stuff. And it came at loads of criticism in the industry because it's sort of loads more work on us. There's extra things we have to do. Fair value statements. I've just done one this morning to confirm. So every product, every platform, every wrapper, every fund, every advice firm has to have a fair value statement that justifies why they think that service or that product or whatever it is represents fair value. So there's all these extra things that are always coming in. And they often get met with criticism because they're more work for us. But ultimately, it's only to try and drive better outcomes. Whether they're perfect solutions is, you know, a different conversation.
Did these come down from the FCA?
Yeah.
Yeah. How often do they kind of come into your industry?
This consumer duty is the most recent one, but I would say, you know, every couple of years, there's something else that gets bolted on, something else we need to think about.
But in the end, do you think it's benefiting the industry? It's like, obviously it's more work for you guys, but it's protecting the consumer, or do you think it's just loads of like paperwork and
I think the idea behind it is right. The idea behind it is right. You know, we should be making the industry. I'm here today sort of airing, you know, what some of my criticisms or concerns would be because it's a great industry and it needs to do better and keep moving in that direction. The challenge is that it becomes ever more costly for us. So I have to pay the regulator to be regulated. I have to pay professional indemnity insurance and all these various costs just to exist. So just to stand still as an advisor and have all the regulations, I have to pay a lot of money every month. And every time these things get bolted on, those costs just seems to keep going up and up.
And you pass those on to the consumer.
And that's the challenge. You
yeah.
know?
And then you'll become more expensive.
Yeah, and then the wheels keep spinning, you know. So that is a challenge we need to find a solution for.
And but do you think the regulator do a good job of looking after the industry?
Generally, yes. Generally, yes. But I think, you know, I was just reading an article on the way down here today about the Neil Woodford saga, because that's still rumbling on. And it looks like the regulator are finally coming out to say, actually, we are now going to seriously do something about it. There's another, the wheels have turned a little bit further on that. So when you look at sagas like that, you can't believe how...
So long that's been going on. I know, for a decade?
Yeah. Longer.
And how, if the regulator was doing a fantastic job, how did we ever get to that place would be the argument, right? So is it perfect? Probably not. I don't know. The intent is right though.
Yeah. Yeah. I look at them and their view of MySpace, you know, the space that you're involved in as well. I'd be interested to hear your opinions on what you think on it. But I know that they take a dim view on influencers. And I think that they look at that 80% that are probably absolute shysters on TikTok and YouTube or whatever. But then they don't look at the social good that's, you know, like sensible creators have done.
Yep.
And I do worry that they'll be a bit heavy-handed. And do you think the YouTube space is a good space within, alongside your kind of world?
Well, look, I mean, I entered the YouTube space a few years ago, which is where we met, because I was trying to find a vehicle to get sort of, you know, tips and guidance out to people that won't ever get to see a financial advisor or planner. Those people that get left behind, that gap of people that otherwise
would. It's like 90% of people.
Yeah, you know, so how can I find a way? Because I can't serve everybody and the advice industry probably can't serve everybody. That was why I entered the space, to try and, you know, do a bit of that. I think you're absolutely right. Sadly, you end up getting tarred with the brush of the majority. It's the same in financial advice. All the regulation that comes on me from the FCA on extra things to clean up your act is actually then regulating the portion of the market that's not doing what I've always done. And yet I get dragged in, you know, everybody gets dragged along that same journey. I think it's the same thing.
Because the problem is, you know, from an incentives perspective, you've got 90% of the UK population who have, they don't understand investing, they don't understand the benefits, whatever. I know it's not that high, but let's just, like, blunt examples. You then have advisors who have that information, but their incentive is to collect assets under management or to speak to rich people. Yeah. And there's enough rich people to serve the small portion of advisors that they never need to speak to the other lot. So you basically say, by having this heavily regulated industry where you can only give advice if you're an advisor, but the advisors only want to speak to rich people, means the majority of the UK get nothing.
Yeah. And I think, and that's still true. And that's still a problem that I haven't solved the riddle of. I've had loads of first sort of phone calls, discovery meetings, as I would call them, with lots of clients over the last few weeks. Not one of them is right for me to take on in that full, you know, my new business under that financial planning mantra. Mainly because they're at the start of the journey and, you know, they're not there yet for that full suite. I always try and impart as much guidance as I can and give them best practices and tips on where you might go to start and all that sort of thing. But it still, is that enough to get them on that journey? You know, there's still, a bit of self-serving to do. They need to find the best resources.
Yeah, and this is like, you know, I hope the regulators look at the space and realize that a million people a month watch my YouTube channel, and those are like 18-year-olds, 20-year-olds, 30-year-olds, whatever age they're at, that have never started, that if they walk into an advisor, the advisor's going to be like, look, I'm going to charge you so much money, it's not worth it, because you're going to want to invest £100 a month and I'm going to want £5 of it or whatever.
Yeah.
And I hope they realize that, you know, there is some good there, and getting people from zero to one is, in a way, a client with £1 million walking into you is going to be some level of okay.
Yeah.
You know, whereas the 18-year-old, if they don't do something, that the outcome will be bad.
Yeah. And also that person with that £1 million at some point on their journey will have started at some point. So how did they start? What did they do differently that the other people aren't doing? And I think, you know, I see lots of financial planners now doing a bit of, you know, the Americanism, a bit of pro bono work, you know, doing a bit of as much as they can. YouTube was my version of that. You know, if I could find a way of putting that out, then it's not advice, but there's guidance involved that is, you know, free for people to consume as much or as little of. Is that enough to get people investing? Well, you would, you know, look at your channel. How many people have started investing that may not have done based on all the content? A lot, I would say.
Yeah. So probably a couple hundred thousand.
Yeah. So that's a pretty good go at it, right? Yeah.
I think, you know, in the end, they make the right decisions and they're trying to protect the consumer. And I'd rather it be regulated heavily than not.
Yeah.
You know, what's this core advice? Does this thing, is it core advice?
Yeah. So I don't know much about this, but this again is about trying to find a vehicle to serve that end of the market, isn't it? That otherwise would never get any kind of advice.
Damien talks money. Available on all major platforms.
You are core advice.
Yeah. No, God, no, no. Get it that right out.
Cut.
Core guidance.
Yeah, core guidance.
FCA coming in the window with SWAT teams.
Yeah,
and stuff.
Yeah. We've
been waiting. Red dots all over my t-shirt. It was him.
Yeah, so do you know much about it or what?
Genuinely not. I don't know much about this latest thing. I know that's the intent. It's to try and find a solution for that end of the market, but I don't know the ins and outs of what it entails.
I like that the advisors care and they're doing the pro bono work, but you can't blame them because no one can work for free.
I know.
You know, exactly. And the incentives are just not quite there. And I think that is the job of the regulator. But I think by expanding guidance and advice, they kind of are, I think they're making good strides there.
Yep.
This whole guidance piece seems to have potential to be like, someone like you in your situation would do this rather than it all be like, I can't say anything because I'm not qualified. And,
exactly.
You know, I don't know your individual circumstances.
But it needs to go further, right? And earlier, you know, education. And, you know, we need to go right back to the whole, you know, I leave school and I can work out what the third side of a triangle is. I've no idea about living on less than I make and saving money and investing, right? But Pythagoras, I'm all over that.
Sorted.
What world is it where that's the skill set you come out with?
Or Henry VIII's, like, marriage history. Divorce, beheaded, died. Divorce, beheaded, survived.
Yeah. Yeah. What is Pi? 3.1415. But how does that help you when you're trying to make money?
Exactly. Like, really. Exactly.
What age do you see most people coming to you? Because like Damon was saying, an 18-year-old comes in with 100 quid a month and then obviously millionaires come in when they're 50s.
Yeah.
Like what age do you normally see people coming to?
I suppose, you know, my typical client, my ideal client, if I was to say to you, who is my ideal client? It is really those people that are probably on the lead up to retirement. Because that's the big thing where most of the value of the stuff that I provide is on that, hinging around that big decision with other bits either side of it. So, you know, most of the value, because when you sit down with someone who's 30, and if I said to you now, when are you going to retire? I mean, it's so hard to answer that question because it feels so abstract. It feels so, you're just getting started. You're just building, you know, so that's really hard. But if you speak to somebody who's 45 or 50 and anybody with any early retirement aspirations, they've definitely thought about what that looks like and when they'd like to. Typically that's when people come to me and that's where most value can be added from the planning, I would say.
So if someone came to you like 31 and they had nice, well-paid job, wouldn't you see that as, oh, I could have them as a client for longer?
Yeah. Yeah. And I've got plenty of those as well. The accumulators, I would call them. Okay. So I sort of bad clients are either accumulators or decumulators.
Okay.
Interesting.
Yeah. You do get plenty of those as well. And they're the future retirement solutions, but they still benefit from a planning conversation.
Yeah.
Still, you know, use all the tax allowances. We're still building the pots. There's still a place for it there for sure.
That's the one thing in my mind that's changed of like, I can see myself at 55 sitting down with someone like you and going, can you just make sure that I'm where I need to be in terms of a planning perspective? In the past, maybe advice was, I know the stock market, you don't. So I'm going to show you how I'm going to pick for you. Whereas your thing is, I know how to make sure that you live your life that you want and get the dreams that you get.
Exactly.
And the stock market tools and the accounts, they're like the vehicle that we get there. But what we need to do is set out the route, the plan. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like one thing that I think the financial advice industry doesn't realize is most people don't know what the hell they get from the service.
Yeah.
They walk in there blind, kind of like a mechanic going like, you know, your flangenator's broke, $7,000.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's the case or not. Whereas you can portray this clear value of like, yes, you'll get the investments. Yes, they'll be tax efficient. Yes, all of that technical stuff. But most of all, you'll know exactly how much money you'll need and you'll know how to get to the life that you want and what that looks like.
Yeah.
Can you tell us the story about the lady and the church? Because I think that's a really good example of this.
Oh, yeah. I'd forgotten about that. Yeah. So long-standing client of mine, lovely, lovely lady, used to look after her and her husband, wealthy couple. He was like some NASA scientist, really interesting guy. And as a result, earned great money and he had a whopping great pension. So really good clients. He sadly passed away a few years ago and he did all the finances. So it was one of those scenarios where, you know, his surviving spouse, she is now burdened with all of the stuff she's now got to work out. He did all of that. And so my role has changed a little bit and has been much more frequent. And one of the things that she said to me, and in a bit of a throwaway comment actually, was this idea of they're religious people. And one thing that he'd always liked to have done is repair. They talked about this church organ at their local church where they go, and it was in a right state. And apparently, can you believe this? To repair the organ would be 50 grand. That's the bill to fix this thing up to the state that it should be in. And so we got talking about that. And the idea of, she would love, wouldn't it be great as a legacy to him to carry out that exercise and almost have a little, his name by a plaque to say, this thing was restored by, but obviously he's no longer here. And so I said, well, why not then? Instead of, it was just a fairly casual conversation. And I said, well, why not do it? And it was a huge sum of money. I can just give 50 grand in one. I can't write a check to the church for 50 grand. So I said, why not? Of course, this is your money. If that's really something that, so let's have a look. And I was able to do the planning bit. And this is why it's so important to still, to be able to show her, you can do it and you'll still be fine. You know, you have the capacity to do this. So she did. And what an amazing thing to be able to have said, you know, that was a real huge emotional moment for her and something that probably without my input, without kind of blowing, it may probably never have happened. Mm. Giving her the confidence and the peace of mind to say, you can make that gift if you want to, you can do that and you will still be absolutely fine. Your retirement plans aren't derailed. You're not going to cause yourself a problem further down the line by making that now. And so as far as I understand it, work is underway.
How do you make that decision? How do you give them that confidence? So what's the technical process?
So it's cash flow modeling. Okay. So it's, you know, I use a really intelligent bit of kit that basically plots the ins and outs every year. So you put in, this is the lifestyle you want to lead. Here's the events along the way, a big holiday, you know, sending the kids through.
50 grand for an organ.
50 grand for an organ. So let's go into your plan, what you're spending, what life costs, what you've got in the pot, what's coming out, and look at that graph. And I'm going to pull 50 grand out of it today and see if, you know, what that does to the graph in later years. And if we're still all right, then why not?
And is that based on like a percentage probability or something of like?
Yeah, there's different ways to do it. But yeah, because these things are full of assumptions, you know, and assume growth rate and, you know, there's different ways of doing it. So they're not perfect, which is why the whole point of setting up these plans is that we revisit it every year, because I'll be wrong every year in terms of what I put into that vehicle. Mm. It will never be right. So you revisit it every year and keep nudging it on.
And one of the, you talked about accumulators and decumulators. How do you manage someone moving from accumulation to decumulation? And how do you think people should spend their money when they're in retirement?
That's a great question. This is the biggest problem people have, is that switching mindset.
Yeah.
I see it all the time. And it doesn't matter whether somebody's got loads of money in the pot or small. And, you know, anybody listening to this that's at that stage, I think will relate to this. It's really hard to go from working your entire life, saving, investing, building, accumulating, to somebody then saying to you, you've now got to start spending it and to be comfortable with spending it and to enjoy spending it. You ask me what's the most important thing to do is to enjoy it, right? I think people get far too wedded to the idea that money is the important thing. It's not important in itself. It doesn't do anything. It's what you can swap it for that's important, right? I always, you know, joke that they're fun tokens. And unless you're going to make that distinction, then what was it all for? You know, if you're going to retire and stress and worry and be really frugal, you know, what was it all for? So again, one of the things I find myself doing a lot of is telling people to spend money, you know, enjoy it. If the plan works, I'm not saying do it recklessly, but with a plan that shows you you'll be fine. If you say that, actually, do you know what? We'd love to go on a couple more holidays a year if we could afford it. Let's have a look. Yes, you can. Do it. Enjoy it. Who's going to spend the money? It's going to be one of three people. It's either going to be you, your beneficiaries after you're no longer here, so the kids or whoever that might be, or the state in one form or the other. Who do you want that to be? Those are the only three people that are going to spend it.
I love like your view of it around happiness and joy. One thing that you said to me that I've been passing it to my mom is that, you know, think about inheritance planning before you're dead in the sense of get the glory.
Yeah.
Sit at the table with them and be like, look how much of a legend I am. Here's your inheritance.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like,
you know, we'll be doing that, definitely.
Yeah, for your son, it's like, you know, you want to be there, be like, look how
I've
much
already planned it for like different stages of his life. So 18, he gets a little bit.
Yeah, and I'm paying for it.
He puts in every month. I put in every month. My missus puts in every month. So yeah, nice. When he's 18, give him something. Then when he's like 21, give him something else, and then, you know, later just give him little pots and be like, this is for your first deposit. Yeah. This is for,
because how good that's going to feel.
Make you feel
keep
great.
Investing into this so that, like, I've got you so far. There's 20 grand in here. If you keep putting it in, you can make this 100 grand. Like, so yeah, things like that, different
I mean,
pots.
And that's what I mean. That's proper financial planning, right? Yeah. Mm. That's what you want to do. So you would say that to me, you know, as a planner, and I would show you that you could do that and that it would make sense. And Yeah, and you'll get to see him enjoy that.
From this conversation, I'm thinking, you said like you would might want to go see someone like him when you're 55. I think it'd be more useful like 40, just to like do the like cash
pushing that as well, aren't you?
Yeah, cash flow.
You're right there now.
Like, yeah, I'm because it's like, make sure you're tax efficient. I think that's really helpful because I mean, I just did my taxes as self-employed and taxes are so confusing. I think everyone finds taxes a little bit confusing. So make sure you're tax efficient, make sure you're planned, make sure you're like worst case scenario, best case scenario, all these things. It'd be good to do.
I think this, like, I worry about money a lot. And I probably sit down with someone like you and you'd be like, chill the hell out. Like, you don't need to be worried about money. It's kind of crazy. The more I earn, the more I go on, the more I save, the more I'm like, is it enough?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I asked the question about accumulation to decumulation because I can see that coming.
Yeah.
Like, I struggle to spend now, let alone when I'm like 50, 60 or whatever.
You'll still be accumulating when you're 70.
I'll be accumulating in the grave.
I know.
Like, he's got a direct debit going into a passive fund still. Yeah.
I look at my nan who's still with us and plenty of money and, you know, sits there with her toes hanging out at the ends of her slippers. And I say to her, Nan, what's going on down there? You know, not she can hear a word I say, but, and there's, you know, 15 pairs of slippers that we've all bought her over the years in the, you know, she's come from a war generation,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
There is no way she's not throwing those slippers away. There's still life in them left. And that's what I mean. That mindset, you'll never get that out of her. Trying to change your mindset now and said to you, Demi, you're done. You've got to spend. It's like, it's really hard emotionally.
Yeah. Like one thing that's like, is this idea of like, they call it coast fire, but it's this idea that you might actually get to a point at some point where you can stop saving because if you just let it ride and let the markets do its thing, you'll be okay. And that's probably a conversation that, or at least I should look at, because what's the point in saving into oblivion so that at 70 I can go on a holiday when I should probably be doing that right now?
You know? And sadly I see this all the time. You know, people end up not as healthy as you thought you might be in the later years and you miss the opportunity. Mm-hmm. Those early years of retirement, let's say you do get to retire early, whatever we mean by early, what do we mean? You know, 50, 55, whatever. That's still considered early. You know, I know lots of us would probably want to do even before that, but those are your years. You're fit and healthy, probably, all fingers crossed. Those are the years to enjoy those holidays.
So you spend big in those early years.
Yeah, so you see a peak. If you spoke to me, you probably would. You'd see a peak in spending then because I'd be here going, come on, let's go and see that auntie in Australia. Let's do it. Because who knows? 10 years' time, you might not feel up for that long flight, for example. You know, I'm the most counterintuitive financial advisor in history, I think, in this regard. I spend much more time saying, come on, you know, let's... All this work we did to this point, let's make it for something. And I come back to that point. I get most job satisfaction.
Yeah.
Out of that moment where I can see something that I've added in the conversation has made them live a better life than they would have done, you know, prior to that conversation. And this is why, so the three questions I ask people when I'm trying to pull out, what do you really want? Is if you had all the money that you needed in the bank right now, how would you change your life on how you're living now? This is from the, I'm going to say his name wrong, George Kinder, Institute of Financial Planning, American chap who sort of coined this over there. So you give somebody all the money in a scenario and say, what would you change? And they'll say things like, well, I'd probably go on a few more holidays. I'd probably go and see that relative I'd never really seen. I might go down to 4 days a week or three. All of a sudden, you start to get, okay, so we're starting to talk about what you want to do with your time more than what you are currently doing with your time. And then what you do is the more awkward part of the conversation is you take away the biggest asset we all take for granted, which is time. You say to them, if you went into the doctor's today and the doctor said to you, you've got between 5 and 10 years left to live. The good news is you won't feel sick. You'll feel as healthy as you both do right now. But you know that is your limited time. Right? Might be 5, might be 10. You don't know when you're going to die, but that is your prognosis. What would you change about how you live now if you knew that was the story? What difference would you make? And that is normally the one where people go, wow, that's made me
think. Just made my heart drop because the answer is I would just spend every minute with my son.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And like, I go to work to provide him a life when in reality I could just, do you know what I mean? Like it makes you think, it makes you think what's important real quick, you know? Yeah.
Because everybody's answer to that question, and you hit the nail on the head, always centers around the idea, I'd spend more time with the people that I love doing the things I enjoy doing.
Yeah.
That's basically what it boils down to, right? So can I show you a world where financially I can push you more in that direction? The third part of that question is even worse to say, what happens if you only had 6 months left to live. You know, the prognosis was
we're
really
going to Vegas too.
Yeah.
Vegas, then Ibiza.
It's going to be big.
Then Bali.
Yeah. But it's you know, asking people who haven't you become that you want to become?
Yeah.
You know, what are the things that you want to achieve? You know, I don't know, I want to write a book, but I need 6 months off work to really sit. I've always dreamt of, I don't know, whatever. Okay, well, can we find a world where you could fund a period of not working for 6 months to write that book? I don't know, I'm coming up with silly stories, but this is what drives me.
Yeah. What advice would you have for someone who's younger then, like 30s or just starting out as a financial advisor? What kind of, you know, if you could advise everyone,
yeah,
what would you be saying?
I always start, because I get this a lot. And on those calls that I have, I mentioned earlier that, look, they're not right. You know, I can't take them on as a proper client. And so we end up having lots of these conversations. I think the best thing that people can do is understand what good foundations look like before you start to invest. I think that would be the biggest takeaway I could have for anyone at the start of the journey is, before you start thinking about investing, make sure your house is in order in terms of things I know you guys talk about, emergency fund in place, get rid of high interest debt, you know, get things to a place that you are ready to take that step for investing. Because I can tell you, if you try and skip that stage through impatience, because I know I did way back when, because I've always been horrifically impatient, it'll probably fall over at some point because something will bite you. If you haven't got an emergency fund, you just know that your car will blow up on a day that you don't want. And then what you're going to do? Sell those investments of a short term when you might, you know. So that's the biggest thing I tell young people at the start. Before, just make sure you're ready. You know, that I think is probably the biggest takeaway.
Yeah, it's people don't realize that an emergency fund is an investment in your investments.
Totally.
Because it stops you from crystallizing. Yeah.
It's your buffer from a bad choice. Yeah. That's the thing.
I have been investing for well over 10 years, but I don't have the money that reflects that. Why? Because in my earlier years, I was putting money in and then taking it back out again, making that mistake of like not having that buffer, the emergency fund. People see it as like, oh, it's not producing a return.
But it
is producing a return. The return is you not locking in a loss or...
Exactly.
Especially because things go wrong when things are going wrong.
Yeah.
It seems like the market's down 20% and that's the day your tiger's...
Your boiler goes, oh, hello, what's that? Market's down. Time for a cold winter. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. That's what happens. Exactly. Yeah. And I think people have bought in, and it's right, you know, the earlier you start, of course, that makes a massive difference to the journey. We all know what compounding looks like and so on. But that's true, but not in favor of, you know, not getting your house in order. You've still got to get that bit right first. You want to start investing when you're ready. That's the biggest thing.
So there was a moment where you, I hope you don't mind me sharing this, but we were talking privately and you said, Damien, I'm done with the world that I'm in, but I've got two choices. I can go work for a financial advice firm and they've offered me great money, you know, like good money a year. And I can just work there as an employee and I can get my money, or I can do this thing that I think is like really risky. I hope will revolutionize the financial advice space, but I'm not sure it'll work. And I said to you, like, you know, first of all, you're speaking to a guy who gave up his job to make the videos in his spare bedroom. So, but you should do the thing that, like, about legacy and this kind of import, like something that makes you feel like you're doing something that's worthwhile. And I don't think the job was that.
Yeah.
Now that you're in it and it's like you're in the throes of that decision, like, do you think it was a good decision that you've made?
My soul says yes. My soul screams yes, actually. And like you said, it's about building something you're proud of, right? I mean, I could have gone down that path and financially been fine, and I could have done the stuff that I want to for my kids, and that story would have played out probably fine. But I'm a big believer as well in, you know, the whole regret thing. What would I regret more? Am I going to look back in 10 years and think, bloody hell, Tom, why didn't you knew what it should have looked like? You just needed to be a bit more brave. And it's like the conversations we had many years ago, you know, when you're thinking of quitting your job to go in your spare room to make videos and you think, what are you going to regret more, Damo? Never trying? Could it work full time? And here we are.
How do people hear more about like your firm and what you're doing? Is it a firm? Is that what you call it?
Yeah, I guess so. So Orca Wealth, it's called, like the killer whale.
Orca Wealth.
I mean, I'd love a better story on where Orca came from. Somebody asked me yesterday, I need to come up. Somebody give me some, what is it? Abbreviations for ORCA, but yeah. They're not all great.
Orcas eat sharks, right?
Yeah.
There you go.
They're savage. That's
it. You're eating what?
You eat the sharks.
Bro, this is why I'm here.
I don't want to say I'm the killer whale of financial services.
Yeah, this is why I get the big bucks. This is why I get the small bucks. Yeah. No, you should see, like, you're eating all the other sharks. The sharks are the not so good financial advisors, and you're the orca eating them all up.
I mean, if you want to call me the killer whale, financial services tea, you call me that, blimey. But yeah.
So, that's a good caption for the
episode. Free Willy.
So Orca Wealth.
You know, Free Willy for everyone.
That's not on the brochure.
That's why I get cancelled.
Yeah. I think I'll come to tea for marketing.
Yeah. Yeah, and like the thing I want people to take from this conversation is like the advisor works for you, not the other way around. Yeah. And I think for the last few decades, it's felt that the relationship's been the other way. Challenge them on the services they offer you. Make sure that like they do what you want and they invest in the way you want. And the key thing is the planning. The planning is the value.
Yeah.
The ability to go, what are you saving for? And have you got enough? These are the questions that we should be asking ourselves, because otherwise, what's the point?
Exactly.
We're just throwing money into a pit.
It's all about value for money, isn't it? You look at the fees, and they're not insignificant fees that I get paid, and I totally understand that. I'm not the cheapest that there is out there to employ. I'll absolutely say that. The FCA did a study. The average cost of a client that's got an advisor involved, the average cost of their investment portfolio is about 1.9%. Mine are way below that. Mainly because of all the cost savings I'm driving through the vehicles that I'm using.
Because you're not paying the active management fees.
Yeah, because most of them are still built on this idea of active management. So you're paying close to 2% is kind of the industry study. So I'm not the cheapest. I'm by far not the most expensive. But it's about value. It's about what are you getting for that fee? And I would argue what I'm doing is a whole different kettle of fish for my fee than what many advisors will be being paid for doing, perhaps not so much.
Yeah, because time's the most valuable thing. And if you give someone an extra few years, then that's probably worth a lot of money, right?
Exactly. I'm working on one at the moment where they've said 60 is their planned retirement, which is still early retirement in terms of, state pension age and all the rest of it. I've challenged them to look at 55, and I've started to build the model. And it has problems at 55, but I'm able to run some different. So how can I solve, if you were to retire at 55, I've got a problem. I can see the problem. There's not enough in the pot, but I've got 10 years left of their working life on that. They're 45. What can we do in that 10 years that's different to what you're doing now to solve that problem? And I have a solution, which next week I'll be going out to say, look, if you did this, we could forget dreaming about 60. We could dream about 55. What price do you pay on 5 years extra of retirement in the years when you're fittest and most healthy?
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah. Yeah.
I can pull it off.
You're amazing, mate. Honestly. We connected over thingy because you slid into my DMs and you were like, can you give me some tips? I was like, there's another bloody chance they're asking me for my
trade secrets. Ignore me for 3 weeks. That's the first thing he did.
Yeah, I did. And then I told you not to bother.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was like, because I'm a shark.
Yeah.
take your little willy and fuck off.
And that's why I stopped making videos. Yeah. I've been gobbled up.
Oh, God.
There's so many choice of words are ridiculous.
And that's the end of that
one. That's the end of that.
And on that note,
we're doing so well.
Here at Mindset Win, we want to give you the tools to become better at what you do.
Taking inspiration and wisdom from our guests, we will hear stories, strategies, tips, and tricks.
Told by leading names in sport and beyond.
Who know what it takes to get to the very top.
There will be 2 episodes each week, packed with amazing stories and practical takeaways for us all to follow.
Search for Mindset Win on YouTube and on your favorite podcast app.
If you want a bullet point summary of this episode, you can sign up to our newsletter using the link in the description.
And don't forget to subscribe to the podcast and leave us a review. It really makes a difference and lets us know that we're doing a good job. And remember, this is not financial advice. The reason it's not financial advice is because it's not tailored to you. We can explain the principles of building wealth, but if you want personalized advice, it's worth speaking to a financial advisor. As with everything financial, please do your own research. We really encourage that because no one cares more about your money.
I'm Damo.
I'm T.
This episode was recorded by Jack Hobbs. Music is by Felix Taylor. It was produced and edited by Ruth Edwards. Johnny Hunter is in charge of marketing, and it's all brought together by Will Stollerman.